Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. Whether you need a portfolio to showcase your work, a store to sell your products and services, or a blog to share your ideas, Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into a reality. Not to mention, with Squarespace's beautifully designed templates and customizable features, creating a beautiful website is a simple and intuitive process. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter the offer code MU to get 10% off your first purchase. Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 5. Coming up on this show, we have the 18th century battle between the Spermists and the Ovists, the latest on Chicago's Mothman sightings, and Nancy Trivolato joins us to discuss her research with the International Academy of Consciousness. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Now, you see, I know what you're going to be talking about today, but for anyone listening to those headlines, when you describe a battle between Ovists and Spermists, I just get a very filthy picture.
It's all about where babies come from. And how miraculous it is when you think of the progression of our understanding of that, how recent our understanding of that is.
Well, true. I mean, only, 200 years ago we were thinking that spontaneous generation was the way that human beings came into existence.
Our understanding of where babies come from is just over 100 years old.
I just love it that you wandered into my office yesterday and showed me this quote of, when a woman menstruates, it drives bees from their hives.
Yes, so this goes into the history of these wild understandings and offshoots in science that eventually led to our current understanding of where babies come from.
It's been a long road, obviously.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's some really strange offshoots where scientists in history just went digging down a rabbit hole and ended up nowhere. But the reference to spermus and ovus was at the end of the 17th century. There really was two opposing factions. And the spermists believe that babies came from sperm and that a woman was really just a field where the seeds were sown. They had no
understanding.
No implication on how the baby would turn out or anything like that. It was just basically they were the container. And the opposing faction were the ovists, who believed that the woman's egg was the primary source of the baby and that the sperm had some kind of strange aura and magic to it. It was just like this weird chemical reaction that caused the egg to come to life.
Isn't it great that they were both wrong, though? That's the best part.
Yeah.
Because they were both wrong and then they were both right at the same time.
So I've picked up this fantastic new book from Edward Dolnick. It's The Seeds of Life, from Aristotle to Da Vinci, from Shark's Teeth to Frog's Pants, The Long and Strange Quest to Discover Where Babies Come From, full of crazy tales, and he goes into all the odd cultures that didn't even make a connection between sex and babies.
What do you mean?
They just never joined the dots on such an obvious thing.
How do you not make a connection between that, though?
They're idiots.
Are there still cultures like that exist?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. I mean, they're all like in some jungle in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, okay. Right.
But they actually don't make that connection. There's all these stories of anthropologists visiting the tribe and them just totally confused. They have no word for father in their language because there's no paternity. There's no link.
Of course, if there's no link.
There's no link between sex and babies. It's absolute madness.
How surreal. That's so weird.
The way they explain it, I think, is just one of the best, most hilarious explanations I've ever heard. I think it's better than storks. It's a really great explanation.
Better than Cabbage Patch and all those sort of concepts. Okay, well, that's cool. Well, look, in the Plus extension, I'm really excited about this because Mothman is back!
He's back!
There's a flap of sightings that are happening in Chicago right now as we speak. There have been 20 really intense sightings this year alone, and I'm really excited to talk about it because I wonder if something else is going on here, especially after we were just talking about pterodactyl sightings. It all kind of links in with some of the stuff I was talking about earlier in the week. So I'm looking forward to extrapolating upon that in the Plus extension.
Yeah, Julie shot me a couple of news articles on some sightings that have just started to appear.
It's pretty intense at the moment. There's definitely something going on. Because obviously after Point Pleasant, things kind of went quiet with Mothman. I mean, there's been the occasional sighting that people claim. But with all the sightings that are happening right now, there's even photographs that are showing up as well. So not from this year. There's photographs from 2011. But there's definitely a pattern of strange activity that's happening around the lake area as well. It seems to be associated with water, which is very unusual.
Is there an impending disaster? Because the Mothman sightings, Some researchers link that to the collapse of the bridge.
That's where I'm going.
Point Pleasant. So is something about to happen in Chicago?
It makes me wonder.
Other than people dying from gun violence every day.
Yeah, I think it's something else. Yeah, we'll wait and see. We'll go into that a little bit later on in the show.
Well, our guest for today is Nancy Trivelato. She's from the International Academy of Consciousness and the Institute of Applied Consciousness Technologies. I think this is a great follow-up from our interview with Bob Berman last week. Again, we're going to be talking about consciousness on this show.
Well, it's more about the application, I think, of consciousness, because when we were talking to Bob, it was very theoretical, I think, and conceptual, whereas Nancy has this application, this approach on how we can utilize these concepts in our daily life.
Well, Nancy's a consciousness researcher and author. She's the co-founder of the Institute of Applied Consciousness Technologies, where she serves as a managing partner and senior consultant. She received a master's in research methods in psychology in the UK. She's also one of the founders for the International Academy of Consciousness, a non-profit institution of which she was a director for many, many years and where she's currently a senior researcher and an instructor. She also went on to establish the Journal of Consciousness, or JOFC, where she served as chief editor for 15 years. And in 2010, Nancy was honoured with the IAC Global Award for Contribution to Consciousness Science. And I first heard about these guys when I was in contact in the desert, speaking with Jeremy and his friend Alpha.
Yeah.
And Alpha mentioned, well, he put it as this kind of wild story about these maverick scientists in Portugal who have bought this wonderful property and they're building some kind of device that can thrust you out of your body. So it immediately made me think of X-Men and Professor Xavier. And I questioned Nancy about this in the interview, and she does indeed confirm.
Well, I would say in a roundabout way, it's confirmed. I wouldn't say it's a complete confirmation, you're right.
They are basically X-Men out in Portugal. Abby just told this amazing story about their out-of-body research and Nancy's husband, Wagner. You know, really, they're both pushing this field forward, trying to do some hard science and figure out what is actually happening with these experiences that, of course, we've covered countless times on the show and that people experience from all walks of life, from all around the world. And when I looked into them, it really impressed me how open-minded they were.
Yes.
And the breadth of what they were researching, but also how down-to-earth and honest they were with the research and how important the scientific method was to them.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think they're up against it because they're talking about topics that, for the most part, if you just brought it up at a dinner party or wherever else, I think most people would think that they're quack topics. I mean, you're talking about consciousness, you're talking about energies, astral projection, the lucid dreaming experience, and most importantly, one of the focuses is the out-of-body experience as well. And I think that, you know, for the most part, there's a lot of woo, a lot of quackery out there, but they really have taken this healthy, scientific, skeptical approach to it, and they're trying to push what the boundaries of consciousness really are. And I think they're making progress. And I especially like it with Nancy that she's trying to also address children. And this is something that comes across in the interview really well, because I think I myself had experiences when I was a little kid. I was terrified. I think we all go through it, though, what I'm saying. Like, I thought there was something in the room. I thought there was something that was hanging around outside. I've had friends that said that they would wake up in the middle of the night to find an old man sitting on the end of their bed or would come up and tap on the window. And as a parent, you don't know how to deal with that.
Was no old man, you should point out.
Yeah, point out, by the way, yes.
It wasn't a creepy uncle or anything.
No, there's nothing like that. But, you know, it was definitely from the point of view of the child that it was a ghost of some kind or an entity, something that was non-physical. But as a parent, it's very difficult. And, of course, the first thing a parent will do is take them to a psychologist or try to seek out some type of psychological assistance. Yeah. But that may not be the case. As we've known from all these reports that we've covered of children over the years, it seems like children are more open to the possibilities of whatever is beyond this physical reality of ours. So the research that Nancy is doing is really making headways into how can we incorporate this into our perception of reality and how can we start to understand the importance of getting this research out there.
Yeah, part of the IAC's mission statement is to provide assistance by clarifying the multidimensional nature of the consciousness and all the implications associated with this reality. And the Academy conducts formal scientific research and facilitates advanced multidimensional self-experimentation. So lots of stuff to go into. We hope you enjoy the interview with Nancy. You can find the website at conscioustech.com and iacworld.org. We'll link to both of those in the show notes. This is Nancy Trivelato. Joining us on the show today is Nancy Trivelato from the International Academy of Consciousness. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you, Ben. I'm very glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you joining us from Portugal. I'm really excited to talk about your work with the IAC, and I understand you've just completed some studies on psychic children. Can't wait to talk about that. But I want to know more about your personal experiences, and I think this is a good way to introduce you to our audience. I understand that you had some very paranormal experiences from an early age. Can you talk about what you went through?
Sure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about that, because I think those are relevant experiences. At least they were for me. I have had different types of experience. I don't like to say that I have had many or they were super strange, because the more I study and the more I research, the more people I encounter, the more I see how normal they are, how often they happen, and the more I see how much I still have to learn, to develop, to research, and maybe to improve in myself. But I have had experiences as a child that for me were very remarkable, especially those ones in which I would feel like detaching from my physical body. It may sound strange for some people, but my research points out that that is super, super, super common in children. Just most of us, when we are at a very young age, we do not have the proper words to understand it. So we cannot even build in our frame of mind an understanding of what the phenomena is. But many instances, I saw my own body sleeping, or I would feel I was floating close to the ceiling. I would see my siblings sleeping around. And there were a few instances of experience that were very, I would say, strong for me, not in a bad sense, in a good sense. One of them was an evening or a night, during the night, in which I woke up and I saw my body again, and the room and everything. And I felt a very, very, very strong vibration inside my body, like in the moment that I was getting closer to the physical body. And it was almost as if I would explode from inside. It was really, really intense, like the house were in an earthquake. But it was pleasant. It was like a nice feeling, but very different. As I was so young, maybe I was 7, 8 at the time, I didn't make much of it. It was a sensation that, you know, passed, and I never mentioned or commented to anyone about that.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had 4 sisters and 2 brothers, so big family. But even with them, I never said anything about it.
Oh, wow. You kept it to yourself the whole time.
Yeah, I just thought, but that is not important, maybe I thought, or I thought everybody has it. It's nothing to be spoken about. So those were not so critical. And there is an experience that I share in my TEDx talk, in which I left the body and I saw something that I never seen in my life or was not supposed to know. And I went to a very big city. I am from a humble, you know, family. We were in a very small city, but I ended up going to the capital of São Paulo city, very huge, huge place. And I saw a hospital, which I have never seen before. And I saw an uncle of mine that was under surgery. So I tell that story in details in my TEDx talk, but that to me was more than just a memory that I had in my mind, and was more than just an interesting phenomenon that I could not explain. It was something that made me really, really interested in research about this, because the facts that I witnessed, I could never, ever known. And then the more I researched, the more I saw people have been describing this type of experience for ages, and the number of accounts we have is huge. But we lack proper tools, methodological tools to study them.
When you say that you went to São Paulo, just so that our audience can understand what your perception was like, tell us about what the sense of travel was. I mean, were you flying? Were you looking down on the city?
You know, I was floating in my room, and all of a sudden, I saw myself looking from above a building, a huge building that I've never seen, like more than 2-story building in my life, and that one was huge. And I saw the cars passing by, but in a flash of a second, I was already inside a room. I assume in that same place I was seeing, I assume. But the room that I saw was the hospital room where my uncle was lying in bed. And he has had a bladder surgery. I didn't even know he was ill. And because of the surgery, he had, of course, all the normal procedures we have when we are in post operation state, but also he had a type of a drainage that was connected to his abdomen, his bladder, as I came to know many years later that he had a bladder surgery for perhaps leaking of the urine, but it would come with some blood together. So it was liquid, reddish liquid. It was very strange to me. That was a little strange, but I was not afraid, was not bad. I didn't make anything out of it. I just thought, for me, it was so natural. It was so funny that when I woke up in the morning, I thought, wow, why is Uncle Gino there? Well, because I never thought I was dreaming, because I was really not dreaming. I was super, super, super awake. All of these experiences, what I would wonder is, how can I be awake if my body is sleeping? Because it's completely different than a state of dream.
Did you tell anyone about what you saw?
Yes, I did. That one I did, because I told my aunt when I saw her again. It took many days after they came back to the small city I used to live. And I told her that I have seen Uncle Gino in a room like this. And then I described everything that I have never seen, not even in movies, not even TV. We didn't have a TV at home or anything like that. So when I saw that, and I described what I saw, she was like, she didn't know what to make of it. She was scared. The truth is, she was scared, because that's what happened when people don't understand things. They are afraid there's some unnatural thing. There is a problem. There might be some evil thing, or they might have to explain, or I may not be normal, or I could not be normal. So she just did not mention about it anymore.
Growing up in Brazil, I presume that your family would have been religious. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. My background was Catholic.
Did this cause any conflict when you told them these experiences?
No, because fortunately my family were like a loose Catholic.
Okay.
We would go to the church once in a while, but we were not like fervent. We were not like those that call God and mention God in our spirit during our everyday life. So it was very light. So, and also in Brazil, there is one thing that I think is positive, because there's so much of the spiritist religion that everybody kind of understand that people don't die, there might be spirits around. But that is something I want to mention later, because even people who are from the spiritist background, they get very confused when there is the need to understand the phenomena they experience, or the need to study about something, or even the need to understand what a child reports.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to understand how your progression proceeded as you got older with these out-of-body experiences. Did you, when did you start to really try and understand what was going on? And when did you realize that this was something that was going to be a really big part of your life?
Perhaps around my 22, 23 years old, because, you know, I got to a point that I started wondering what was really important for me to do and what was really important for me to study. And of course, I think as anybody in this age, I look for careers and I look for different things that I could do that would touch people's life. But I had in my memory some of these experiences of mine, not only those that I mentioned, but also, Ben, some of the experiences I had were very frightening.
Can you talk about those?
Yes, of course. None of them were, fortunately, out-of-body experiences. And from my research and what I've heard from both from kids and adults who have had experience as kids, it seems that out-of-body experience very rarely frighten kids or are frightening, only in very, very negative cases. But other things that happen normally frighten kids and frightened me a lot. There was a period in my life, it was later in my life, maybe around my 10 years old or 12, in which I would sense very clearly some presences around. But I was absolutely lucid, awake. It would be during the day, during the night, but during the night was much, much aggravated, because, you know, I would be sleeping super silent in the house, very, very dark, and I would just be kind of awakened in the middle of the night. And I say kind of awakened because I would wake up every night almost, like hearing somebody calling my name or feeling somebody touching me. But as soon as I wake up and I sense, and I would hear people laughing or talking. It's not exactly that that was physical, but it was so vivid, that it was, you know, for me, no doubt. And I must say here that I never, ever, ever in my life touched any type of drugs. And I have a very healthy family, everybody. So no psychiatric history in the family. So then later on, because of these experiences, Ben, that intrigued me, because the positive experiences, such as those I mentioned in the beginning, made me think these are important phenomena to be understood without religions mixed with it, without mystical approach. And what I mean by mystical approach is without anyone saying this is special, you are so good. There's nothing of being special. This is a regular thing. Unfortunately, we do not understand enough. And I think many people could develop if they wanted. So this made me want to study, but also the fearful experiences that I had made me want even more to study, because I kept thinking how many people go through that, how many people somehow in their lives get even traumatized or have moments in childhood, as it was for me. For me, it was at least 1 year that I had that very strongly, that was very painful year. I was afraid of going to bed. So how can a kid be afraid of going to bed? And in the morning, when I wanted to tell my mother, I didn't have words to say. I didn't know what to say, because children, and that has been very much also the result of my studies, children lack a proper meaning to describe such complex experiences, because it mixes feelings, it mixes with perceptions that are not visible. You are not seeing things. And if you are seeing things that are not there, you even cannot explain how it is going on. So I would only say to my mother, oh, I am afraid, I am afraid. But she didn't know afraid of what. She didn't know what to do. She would just try to say, oh, never mind, there's nothing, everything's okay. But
yeah,
it doesn't help.
We cover a varied amount of stories on the show, but quite often we like to center on people's experiences. And we've found a pattern that, especially that age group you mentioned, you know, after 10 and between the ages of 10 and 13, this is, seems like a window period where some negative experiences can come in. It's not always the case. But, you know, we've talked about cases where, just where you're describing, a young person will be trying to explain to the authority figures in their life, their mother or their father, what they've been going through. And because of this lack of understanding of these things in our society, you often hear that response from the parent of, oh, it's just a dream, don't worry about it, it's not real. And we've covered a few cases where there seems to be lasting psychological effects with the child. And as they grow up, they have, you know, real issues that emerge from this lack of being able to confide in someone or just having someone believe you. So I think it's really important that you have this compassionate approach to dive into this research. And, you know, Nancy, when I first heard about what you and your co-founder, Wagner Allegretti, were doing in Portugal, it was through our mutual friend, Alpha, who said, you've got to speak to these guys because they've built something quite miraculous out in Portugal. And I wanted to hear this story from you of how you guys started with the IAC and what you've set out to achieve.
Yes, sure. When I was, of course, in the path of researching and studying about these topics, I met my husband, my current husband. He has been with me, or we have been together for maybe over 25 years now. It's quite a lot of time that we have been working together. But we started, you know, trying to bring more connections in terms of people who research this and bringing more attention, but in a serious way to the topic. Until finally, we were working in Portugal in a group of friends, we had the idea of establishing a center where would be the ideal place for people to develop their sensations in terms of subtle energies, or maybe to be able to experience out-of-body experiences, to understand what there is beyond their physical bodies. Because all of us, I guess, would like to improve within, or from within, would like to improve our awareness of the non-physical world. But not always we have the proper means or the proper environment. So we create what we call the IAC campus. It's really beautiful, beautiful place in the middle of the woods. Very nice area. And the buildings we have per se, the structures are especially designed to facilitate, I would say, different types of experiences like a cosmo-consciousness or samadhi or the out-of-body experience or the sensation. Yes, or the sensations of one's chakras and energy body. And it seems to result very, very, very good for most people.
You see, this is what got me really interested, because when I was in California speaking to Alpha and he mentioned what you guys are doing in Portugal, the way he described it, and he had had a few drinks at the time, so I don't know how accurate this is.
Or he was super honest, or maybe.
Well, the way he described it is he said, you have built some kind of facility that can induce out-of-body experiences. Now, in my mind, I pictured it like some kind of secret X-Men facility, but how much exaggeration was he doing? I mean, I've never had an out-of-body experience. Can I go to the IAC headquarters and have an out-of-body experience?
No, that is not guaranteed, of course. Maybe it's half true and half what we would like to be. The half truth is actually what you said. It's almost like an X-Men facility. I'm just saying this as a joke, but it's because it looks like the Cerebro. The place we built is a complete sphere. It's a hollow sphere.
Oh, it is a sphere.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Exactly like the Cerebro. And where the person lies down is in the center, exactly like Dr. Xavier would be in the Cerebro for the X-Men. So you were quite accurate. And what Alpha said is true, because the building was created and we put a lot of study and work and research and effort and actually investment there to build something that is for one person only to use at a time. Because we see that sometimes the environment, but not only the physical environment, but the type of energies you would have in that environment, the accumulation of experience, the quality, the information, I put it this way, the information of the energies of an environment can affect a lot the capacity of the person to have or not experience and to have good experience or not. Now, the point is that facilitates, that has positive factors, but that is not going to take somebody outside of the body. It's still the person's effort. So somebody with more predisposition that is very open, or somebody who applies a technique, have much, much higher chances there of sensing the separation, of sensing aspects of their energy body, of sensing the non-physical dimension, and of leaving the body. Many people do. But it's not like the building does it. It just create the proper condition.
I understand. So do you get a chance to use Professor Xavier's sphere often? Do you get a chance to go in there?
Not as often as I would like, but I do visit once in a while because I love the energies there. I love it. And it's such a different atmosphere. Some people just enter there and immediately they sense something that almost gets us a little bit off our so dense aspect of life in a way. So wow. I do go there, and I have had some nice experiences there, indeed.
As I'm browsing iscworld.org, one of your key websites, I'm seeing that, you know, you guys have this approach where you try and enable people to have some of these experiences, and it's very broad what you do. But I also want to talk about some of the serious scientific research that you've been conducting. It seems like this is also one of your main focuses. And before we connected online, we were talking about some of your very new research into psychic children. I wanted to kind of open this up to you and perhaps get a sense of some of this cutting-edge stuff you're working on and what you've discovered.
Sure, Ben. Thank you for that. You know, I have been thinking how important it is that if we want to educate people about the natural aspect of these phenomena, it's important that we help children to see it in a good way. What I see is that right now we have different angles to understand these phenomena in the society. And of course, that affects how science sees it, and science also affects society. One of the angles is that people see these as just far-fetched fantasy. people who mention anything about the existence of life beyond this life, it's just people who are uneducated. That comes from a long tradition with the establishment of the Cartesian approach we have in our scientific paradigm. But I think that affects us deeply. Some people are even ashamed of saying of their experiences, and others, you just mentioned you studied, and they think you are stupid, frankly. Because
yes, it's still a taboo.
Yes, this is still a taboo. It's like, oh, doesn't make sense. You study that. My study is more important than yours because I'm studying neurons, which is absolutely important. But what I mean is we have to put things together. So we have that angle. We have another approach that are those that believe in anything. And that I dislike as much as I dislike the first one.
Yeah.
Because both are terribly detrimental to the development of understanding of this area. Because if we cannot disregard or dismiss, we cannot believe without proper judgment either. In despite of all my experience, and despite that I have been studying this for basically 30 years, more than 30 years, despite that I have written a book about energy body and so forth, what I always try to do is to see what makes sense or not, what is logical or not, because people exaggerate, people confuse, and I think that is also detrimental. So it's not a matter of it doesn't exist, it's not a matter of I believe. And we would like, when I say we, I say I, other researchers of the IAC, and the community I work with, we try to see this as something that is natural and needs more understanding. What we would like to accomplish, Ben, if you allow me a parenthesis here, it's two different things, actually. One is, in terms of maybe a humanitarian work, more directly to people, there are many people who would like to understand this, but more importantly, there are people who need to understand this. Why do they need? Because they have sometimes experiences like I've had that they need to understand. Sometimes they are traumatized by something. Sometimes they see, for example, events happening in their lives that coincidence cannot explain, and they know there are other forces. Sometimes a loved one passed away and they want to understand what's going on. For whatever reason, people many times need to understand, or they would like to develop their, I don't like to say psychic capacities because sounds sometimes like some divine thing, but maybe yeah, their psi capacities, like sign PSI, or in their maybe non-ordinary capacity. So people like to develop because they feel there's something else. So for those people, those are the ones that we want to help. So we actually teach them maybe the big amount of information that is already available. So we create a structure that presents this in a reasonable way. But more than that, we would like also to contribute to science and to affect science in a good way, in some aspect. Because if we can do serious study about this, perhaps we can start bringing more attention of real scientific approaches or scientists or different areas to the fact that we cannot continue dismissing this phenomena. That does not mean all that is said is real, because as I already mentioned, people fantasize, people confuse, but there is a lot of factual information. There's a lot of anecdotes that have confirmation. We must see those things. So if science could understand that, could include that, not in a way that is becoming metaphysical or mystical, but just in a way that is another complex phenomena it is studying, it would help a lot. It would reduce, I think, lots of the current problems we have in our society, because one of the problems is people only think of this moment. People don't see far away enough to polish their principles, I believe. So it all becomes very confusing.
Well, just on that first note, you're saying that people always have these experiences, and we've found that's the case across all walks of life and all places across the earth. People have these strange experiences. But I think it's really important what you guys are doing is giving people a structured, a logical, down-to-earth place where they can go and develop or understand partly what's going on with them. Because I think with the people that just believe everything that you mentioned earlier, you know, this kind of fluffy, ultra new age side of things that we see associated with this phenomenon. If you're experiencing something, that's usually where you end up. I mean, if you Google search, I had a strange experience, you'll end up usually somewhere online that is someone who just believes in everything. So I think it's really important what you guys are doing. But how do you, I mean, this is a really tricky thing. How do you tell the difference? How do you filter out the science from the pseudoscience?
That is really not so simple. For me now, of course, after 30 years working with it, I see the goals of what people are perhaps establishing in their research or even in their speech. I see how much they try to push the information, because one thing is us discussing and presenting the information. A different thing is trying to lead others to think in a certain way. And I think that is never correct, cannot be correct in any area, much less in this one. And I also think there is a sense of self-skepticism about the person, the personal experiences, but also about the study, that is healthy. And when you don't see that, I think that is a problem. Because when I have an experience, first thing that I do is to think, was it lucid enough? In which condition this happened? Could anything have messed with my mind in that moment? Anything, I mean, a dream, for example. There are so many different states of consciousness that can interfere. So I always, always am very skeptical of my own experiences, and only those that I am absolutely sure I will assume are some sort of non-ordinary experience. I do the same when somebody tells me their experience. I listen, I pay attention, I know patterns. I have studied not only from research, but also reading literature of serious people who had same type of maybe attitude when analyzing the phenomenon. So you get patterns. So by the patterns, you can see. And for me, that's how I use. How would the, let's say, mainstream science appreciate what's serious or not? If they do not understand how the phenomena works, they cannot appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is the great challenge. I mean, how do you present these metaphysical understandings to a scientific world that is purely focused on the physical? It's a materialist paradigm. I think it's great that you guys are systematically trying to organize these things. I think, you know, there's a ton of great research out there, but it's very hard for people to find it and understand it in a systematic way. So I want to come back to some of the teaching classes that you guys do, some of the development programs, in a moment. But when we come back after the break, I really want you to explain some of your recent research on psychic children. We'll be back with Nancy Trivelato from the International Academy of Consciousness right after this. Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. Whatever your next big idea might be, count on Squarespace to help you create an eye-catching online platform that brings it to life. You can even get a unique domain, which strengthens your brand and makes it easier for visitors to find you. And I was looking at their updates, feature updates for the last month.
Yeah.
And they've added a bunch of top-level domains. So they've got .art.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
.shop. .wan.
.wan?
Wine.
Oh, wine.
Sorry. I don't know why I use that accent.
I know, yeah. Where did that come from?
.games.
That's cool.
And .salon. There's a bunch of them.
You know what's interesting? I just noticed that the latest Pixar site for Cars 3 is powered by Squarespace. You've got these big names in entertainment that are using companies like Squarespace. It just goes to show you how cutting edge and how great your website can look.
I don't care about that. I want us to have a .salon domain name.
I want .wine.
Starting from today, all mysterious properties will be moved to mysteriousuniverse.org.salon.
It doesn't work that way. It can't be .org.salon. It's going to be just .salon.
Sorry, did I say that?
Yeah,
I
you
mean,
did. Yeah.
Mysteriousuniverse.salon. You know what I mean.
I think that's a great idea. Well, look, with Squarespace's award-winning templates, you can create a beautiful website simply with their intuitive process. You can add and arrange your content and features with the click of a mouse. And of course, if you get stuck, they've got award-winning 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week customer support, which can help you with any problem you may have, no matter how technical or trivial seeming. I mean, really, you think of it like your own IT department. So make your next move and start your free trial at squarespace.com today. Enter the offer code MU. That'll give you 10% off your first purchase. And make sure you check it out. Use MU as the offer code.
Now, Nancy, I've been dying to hear about your latest research on psychic children. Tell us what you've discovered.
Some of the things that I found out, for me, some were a surprise. Others I expected. Of course, this is a exploratory research because I want Ben to write a book about this. And I mentioned to you when we were speaking before the interview that my book, of course, I cannot reach children 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years old. I have to write to parents. And the challenge will be, how do I put a language that is universal enough that all parents would accept, no matter their religions and their background. But what I found out is that these experiences are much more common than I expected. Because,
really?
Because I have had my experiences, I thought all or most would be similar. But it's not true. Some patterns, they repeat a lot. But certain things that I thought were a pattern, they are not. For example, there is a good number of children who do perceive all of these aspects that I did, but they don't feel fear. So then
really?
I have to, yeah, so that's quite interesting. So then I have to research what causes children to feel fear. And two aspects I have noticed in this exploratory research so far. And I say exploratory because I'm continuing to get the information to write the book. So far, I'm publishing, let's say, articles, papers on that. But two aspects. The first aspect is religion. If you come from a religious family, you are more prone to be afraid because you will interpret that as there's something wrong. It shouldn't happen. It's a demon thing. You have in your mind, most people that are very religious, they have in their minds a type of observation of their own behavior or their conduct that is usually punitive. It's punishing. It's, almost guided by fear. So it tends to somehow mix with the interpretation of their experiences. So children that are very religious. I have spoken with people from 13 different countries. So I'm not talking about only one culture here. What I did was in-depth interview, hours and hours and hours of talking to people, letting them tell their experiences, guiding little, but picking information from their real speech so I would not interfere. So it was very complex what I did so far. But I have had even people that were like very extremist Islamic people as kids, because their parents were. So I see how that influenced them and how their experience could have been different. So that is one thing, religion. The second thing that I would say affects children and make them feel fear is actual, how would I say, negative things around. Because I have had a number of cases in which a child would feel afraid having one type of experience. I'll give here an example, okay? Let's say clairaudience, hearing people talking to her or to him. Or let's say clairvoyance, or even sensing touch. The child would have the very same phenomena in one house and feel zero fear. And in another house, be super afraid. And every time the phenomena would repeat in that same house, it would be fearful because they would perceive presences. Thing is that some of these cases, the child later could confirm, like, for example, there was a sister or a brother who would sense the very same thing in that place. There is a very interesting case of a lady. Today, she's a medical doctor. She's a mother. She's 33, I think, or 34 nowadays. Very balanced, very beautiful person. But when she was a child, she used to have terrible, terrible experiences. She said, I would wake up every night and have many nightmares every night. She thought it was normal because her sister would have the same, waking up every night with the same type of nightmare, both of them. But they wouldn't speak much about their experience except for the nightmares that they shared. Later, many years later, like after all of this was solved in her life, she was already an adult, she mentioned to her father, to her parents. And her father told her that when he was a kid in that house, he used to have the very same experience. But this, it's amazing. But this same girl, when she was, for example, in a friend's house, or she would go to their vacation house, which was quite often, or any other place, she would feel zero fear. So it's amazing.
This is, I mean, obviously this is an initial finding that you have, but I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, clearly there's something to do with the environment. With people that have these sensitive abilities, there's something about the environment that's affecting them.
Yes.
And the nature of what's in that environment, I guess.
That's what I'm trying to say. So these are the two things that cause fear. So if we leave children, you know, to have their experience, if we let them have their experiences without interfering, without telling them this is good, this is bad, just let them comment and appreciate and explain to them other similar examples. Just let them grow. They won't be afraid, most probably, unless there's something really wrong there. And if there is, well, let's help the poor child, right? Because how can the child solve this on his own or her own? It's not possible.
We've heard examples like that time and time again with poltergeist phenomenon, where it seems to be directly related to the house.
Yes.
And as soon as the family moves away from the house, everything's okay.
Everything's okay, yes. And of course, we have few cases of poltergeists to study, so it's always a question mark. But when I start interviewing people, doing this research, I see that if we are going to study about just non-ordinary phenomena in general, more like a size sensitivity, we do have a large number of data because it's so much more common. And we should take it more serious. That's what I mean. If it's just a fantasy of a child, it would be always, or it would be more in a dark place, would be more when the child is alone. And that's not true. There was a 2.5-year-old child, very briefly here. The mother is a medical doctor. And I spoke with the child. Of course, the mother was together there. And after I spoke with the child's very happy, normal, playing, goes to school. But there was one night that the child was actually two or just before two. Child woke up crying and pointed to the mother saying, there is a man sitting there dressing like this and this and this, and describe all detail. And then mother, very, very scared, just gets the child and goes to another room. Let's play, blah, 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 to distract the child. They go back. The child points to the same corner and repeats the same thing. And that went back and forth like 3-4 times. And the mother does not know anything about psychic phenomena, does not know anything about the non-physical reality. So how can this mother help this child?
Yeah, yeah, great point. What do you do? You just you brought back childhood memories, because my mother used to tell me that I would scare her half to death because I would do the same thing. I would point my finger up into the corner of the bedroom and tell my mother that the spaceman was there.
Yes.
She didn't know what to do. I can't remember it, but she used to tell me that story. Apparently I used to do this, and I would try and convince her that the spaceman was there. I don't know if that means anything, but it brought up that memory.
But it does make it strange that a child would say that if it's not dreaming, if he's not have been watching movie about that, because of course the child has been reading a cartoon or watching a cartoon, maybe the child will fantasize. But when it's something completely out of the blue, we have to examine. And what I would love to do, Ben, is to study all of these cases, like, for example, situations like what you are saying. Maybe if I were interviewing you, I would ask more about what happened later, when it stopped, blah, blah, blah. So we get information so parents can know, oh, it's just an imagination. Maybe my child is starting to, you know, creating too many fantasies. Maybe it's real. To what extent can parents somehow, you know the actuality, the fact of that isn't there?
Well, I wanted to talk about the consciousness development program that you run with the IAC. And I understand you have offices all around the world, or offshoots of the organization all around the world. Can you talk about what you try and help people develop? I mean, what is a consciousness development program? What are you trying to get out of it when you do it?
You know, I was one of the persons who created the Consciousness Development Program, and it's the IAC's signature course, like we call it, because it is like a core course, a core curriculum. And what we do there is that we give like an overview of all of the different studies and the logics for the non-physical phenomenon to happen, the mechanisms of the what we call multidimensional relationships, how we are here, but something that is not physical can affect us and vice versa. The reason I say this is because I think people need to understand whys. Instead of just saying, this is this, oh, experience that, oh, concentrate and feel an energy in your body. We don't do that. What we do is, this happens, for example, the out-of-body experience happens because ABC, there is a connection here. Putting all of these authors together, we observe that the consensus is such. So then we start leading people to, number one, feel their own energy body, feel their own energies. And number two, to understand the non-physical, subtle world that is, you know, involves all of us. Somehow it's interconnected. It affects us and we affect it all the time. And I think everybody senses it, but just people find different explanations. So we kind of help people to distinguish what sensations are those related to these, how they can make themselves more balanced, how they can sense more or less. So what we do in the CDP is to present the information, but at the same time to present the tools so that people can develop by themselves. And we do not want to create any type of dependency. So everything is based on we teach you everything we know. And of course, we establish a sequence that we think is more natural for the development of all of these.
Yeah, I'm looking through the four modules here, and there really is some fascinating theoretical modules, and of course it all has practical stuff as well. But, you know, when I see these kinds of courses that are presented around the world, I'm always very skeptical of them. I always question the motives of these courses and what they're leading people to do.
Yes.
I mean, everything on the surface looks good with what you guys are doing.
Yes.
But I mean, how can I distinguish between what the IAC is offering and, you know, someone who I might pay, I don't know, $300 to learn how to channel Ashtar or learn how to heal cancer in 3 days? I mean, why is the IAC different?
Well, I think your question is super, super important. And I would ask the same thing, because I agree with you. On the surface, it's amazing. Everything looks the same. Even if you get, sorry to say, Scientology on the surface,
yeah,
they look the same.
Yeah.
They are helping you with tools to grow, to become more sensitive, and even to have astral travel. And so how do we distinguish? I think we have to see the values and principles of the organization behind it, number one. I think we have to see who benefits from that, because in the case of IAC, and in the case of our research, there is not a direct benefit. On the contrary, we are working basically for free to offer this information to those who are interested. I think also we have to see how much people push others to do this and to be stick. You have to learn with me. And once you do one course, you have to do another. You have to get stuck here. So we don't have any of that. Our principle is pretty much we want to empower you to know yourself, to be independent, so that the very same thing you mentioned does not happen. Because I think when people really understand the whys, how things really happen, the research behind, they will be able to better judge what is a substantiated information and what's a good path for them and what's not. Having said that, Ben, just a comment here about human nature. It's a little bit sad because sometimes, like in our courses, like in the Consciousness Development Program, we make so much effort for people to use their rationality, to see things as natural, to follow their own discernment. But still, sometimes, despite of everything we teach, we just see people engaging to another belief of something that doesn't make sense. Some people, they just want to have something to believe. And the more far-fetched it is, the better. And if we put there a number of quantum mechanics words and say there is some numbers and put a crazy equation that makes no sense at all, then people will go for it. And if you create a mantra that says it's going to connect you with a divine spirit, and if I give the name to the spirit, then people go for it. We don't have any of that. We don't have easy tools. We don't have easy solution. We don't promise everybody's going to become perfect, or we don't promise everybody will become like somebody with super paranormal powers. We just promise we are going to offer very coherent information with no manipulation whatsoever behind it, that the techniques are presented in a way that are healthy enough for people to practice and understand what's behind it. Because another parenthesis I want to make, some techniques people learn in some places not only are useless, but are negative.
Yeah, that's sort of the point I was getting at. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think a lot of these courses you see online especially lead people down a path of that's not necessarily upright in a way, which is, I actually wanted to drill into a couple of things from some of your modules, because with other out-of-body researchers especially that we've spoken about in the past, the likes of Robert Munro and John C. Lilly comes to mind as well, often they reach a point in what they're pursuing and there seems to be a communication that is made with the other side. There seems to be some kind of intelligence that breaks through. And I noticed that in module 2 of your consciousness development programs, you do mention beings inside and outside the human body and advanced non-physical beings, extra physical helpers and mentors. Can you speak briefly about how the IAC handles this when there is some kind of so-called communication being made with intelligent beings?
Of course. Not only from experiences and from the, let's say, reports of people, accounts, but also research. Research on near-death experience, for example. Also research on the past life recall. There are serious research, although 99% of what is out there is, don't even tell me, not even worth reading. But there are serious research. But when we study these cases that have been observed, that points out that there are people living around us, not everybody, not everywhere, not everyone. Of course, there are some logics to it, but there are people living around us who do not have a physical body. We have a model. We need a model to explain. And the best explanation, the best model we have at the moment is that we use a physical body now, but when we pass away, we don't cease to exist. We continue to exist in subtler forms with a subtler body. And for those of us who are more sensitive, we can perceive these presences. We also think in our model that there is some sort of energy that is very, how would I say, same level or same type of energy that constitutes our energy body. I'm trying to find simple words here. It's
been difficult. Yeah, sure.
Same energies that constitute our physical body, as if it were like a energy from a certain dimension, because I'm not talking about a physical energy, but I'm not talking about a very spiritual. It's something that is in our physical body, but it's not physical. That energy is what allows us to connect with others, like these beings that are non-physical beings. And this is also the very same aspect that allows us to leave the body, because we are connected to the physical body based on these energies. These energies connect us to the physical body. So we go out, we come back. When somebody thinks bad of me and I feel a big negative hit, it's because I got energies from that person with certain quality, certain information, and those energies hit my energy body and affected me in a specific way. So based on all of these observations, from research, from personal experiences, and from maybe even the logics of things, we teach people on how to sense when it is the case. Indeed, there are cases, Ben, in where, of course, I think the audience should know many cases like that too, where people get information that they could never have got in any way. There are children who see relatives that they never knew existed. There are children who get, for example, messages sometimes even with numbers and details that it's impossible to explain only saying it is imagination. So this is what we teach. We teach what is logical about it and what is not and what could be possible ways of verifying it. But we are not saying everybody senses it. We are not saying there are all sorts of people everywhere. We are not saying there are mysterious, mystical angels or whatever. Some people call it angels because they don't have a better word. So when you
you need the vocabulary for it. Yeah,
you need the vocabulary. So you call a good one is an angel, a bad one is a demon. There are no demons or angels. Even if we think about us human beings, who is good and who is bad? Maybe we are a blend. I would love to think we are a blend of much more good than bad.
Yeah.
But we are a blend.
Interestingly, on the recent membership shows, we've been talking about Eastern concepts of possessing spirits. And I wanted to throw this at you because I'm wondering if your research and through your instructional modules, this comes up as well. I guess what I'm asking is how important is the subtle body? How much does it influence your physical health and well-being? And have you come across instances where beings also can influence that subtle body and therefore our own physical health?
It influences a lot. I wrote a 600-page book about that.
Okay. And is that book in English? That book's only in Portuguese, isn't it?
No, it just came out in English
a couple of
months ago. Yes, yes.
I'm going to order it then.
Because it does influence our health, but our state of mind. Because if you exchange energies and information can come with those energies, that can influence you for better and for worse. There are sometimes thoughts and emotions that we have that they resemble some of ours, but they appear in awkward moments or sometimes for no reason, that they may be just picked from the environment or from someone physical or non-physical. So in order to distinguish that, the number one thing the person needs is a very good mental health. Because when I mention this, Ben, to somebody who is not, how would I say it, very rational in terms of discerning things, the person may start thinking, oh, so there are people looking at me everywhere and everything I do is influenced. Absolutely not. But sometimes some of the things that we experience may be influenced in the same way we may influence others. We are exchanging energies the whole time, but that is a very natural process that has, how would I say, a degree of influence depending on people. Nonetheless, we do know cases of people who may have a possession, and we do study about that, but we study to teach people how to have better self-defense with their energies, but also to teach people how to be more ethical in the application of their energies, because it doesn't make sense if we study about energy just for, hey, I'm going to be stronger with more self-defense, but am I not going to be more ethical? Am I not going to be more careful on how I apply my energies? And I know we are at the time of finishing. I'm going to comment something very quick. We had here in Portugal, I think it was about 3 years ago, so popular that was filmed, and they went to a church, one of those old church somewhere, and the woman was dressed in costumes like from maybe the 1200s or something, and it was an actress. She knew nothing about any of that. All of a sudden she got possessed and started speaking in tongues and saying things that was absolutely incredible language she never knew of. So how do we explain something like that? And if this can happen, this is a very extreme case, let's be logical and think in much, 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 much milder level, how much could this influence us? And if does influence us, and if energy, our subtle energy, our energy body interacts with the physical body of ours, if we have healthier energies, more vitalized, could that be also beneficial to us intellectually and also physically? It can. But all of us, we are going to die of something. I'm not saying we have the cure for everything, and, you know. But there are tools. and tools that are important for us to understand, to defend ourselves and to use for our benefit.
Often with these courses and this kind of training, there's a lot of focus and emphasis on techniques and understanding theory. You know, a lot of there's always some kind of secret thing that you need to unlock to, you know, experience these things or have these abilities. But very, very rarely do I see ethics included in these kinds of things. So I noticed that in module four, you have things like karma brought up and past lives and things like that. How does ethics for the IAC tie into this? How important is ethics in what you do?
Well, I would like to say that this is, for us, the most important thing. We try, of course, and I'm going to say it, but we strive to be the more ethical as possible, but we like to study of something that is more than just the ethics from the physical point of view of the physical life, and then we call it cosmoethics, as probably you see there in the...
That's a new one.
the reason why we call it cosmoethics is because if we are thinking of ethics only from the physical point of view of physical life, there are things that would be okay for us to do. But when we think that the energy, these subtle energies can affect others, then our thoughts can affect others. But we cannot assume we are seeing everything. When we leave the body, we feel like all of a sudden, oh, this is what it is then. That is the real reality. Because we notice there are other layers of reality, subtler ones, that interact with ours. But we are almost like in a radio, you know, the dial is stuck in one point. We are with yes. The dial is stuck in the physical dimension. And we only sense the physical dimension, not only, but most people only sense the physical dimension. So teaching people about that, it's much more likely to help people to be more ethical, to see all of these aspects. So this is what we emphasize the whole time. Even if we don't say it, this is what is behind our message. And I like very much your questions. I loved that I'm here and you ask them because I'm passionate in talking about that. Because you can hear somebody saying the same words, giving the same class. They can get your notes and memorize and repeat your notes. But there is something behind it. There is like a message, even in the tone of the voice or how it's implemented in the examples. The message behind is super important. And I think the message of ethics is behind what we do the whole time, every class. At least that's how I see it. That's what I know. And that's how the course was devised to be and how myself and Wagner mostly dedicated to create the consciousness development program.
I think he really hit the nail on the head in regards to how our material experience, our being stuck in this physical dimension is just one sliver of the universe, of the cosmos. You know, it sounds like you guys really have a great understanding of that. And I love this word, cosmoethics. That's my favorite word of the week now.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time. And I'm really pleased to hear that your book is now available in English. What's the title?
It's Vibrational State and Energy Resonance.
Fantastic. I'm going to grab a link from you after we're finished, and I'll put that in the show notes for this episode. You can find Nancy's work at iacworld.org. And I'll link to your YouTube channel in our show notes as well. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we go?
No, Ben. I just want to say that it was lovely. I will be open to talk to you anytime again, whenever you want. And if anybody wants to connect with me, they can reach me through IAC. They can also reach me through IACT. It's actually easier through IACT. That is the Institute for Applied Consciousness Technologies. Just because IACT is it's a smaller organization, so normally it's easier to reach me. I travel so much around the world, but by all means, I will be very glad. And also, if anybody has any experience in terms of children's experience of themselves, or if they have a kid and they would like to contribute to my research with information, I think that is the message that I would like to leave, because I think the more we can put data together, the more we understand about this.
Well, wonderful work. We wish you the best with what you're doing with the ISC, and thank you so much for your time this evening.
Thank you, Ben. It was great. Thanks.
Huge thanks again to Nancy for appearing on the show. You can find her at consciousnesstech.com, and the IAC's website is iacworld.org. It was really a pleasure to speak with her because I really found, at least from what I can see, she comes across and their organization comes across as very authentic, very honest and truthful. And as we discussed in the interview, there's so many places that offer courses in this genre that are very expensive.
You mean like a raw cacao ceremony, for example?
Yeah, or, you know, Stephen Greer takes you out to contact aliens mm-hmm. for 15 grand or whatever
oh
it is.
Oh, God.
And we were looking at their development programs today, and it's $500.
Yeah,
for which nearly 40 hours instruction.
I was going to say, I mean, $500, you know, initially sounds like a lot, but it's a huge course that they have running and it covers so many topics. And you're right, it really does seem that they are essentially on the level with the ideas they're talking about. They're trying to come at something which is very much considered to be new age from a scientific perspective.
And it's a non-profit organization, so you don't get the sense that they're money grabbing, which is so rife.
Oh, absolutely.
In the topics that we cover. Yeah. I mean, we have to be honest. There is so many scams out there. There's so many fraudulent people that Nancy especially struck me as someone, you know, really trustworthy and sincere in getting to the bottom of what's going on.
I was thinking about this through the interview, actually, and I don't think I probably ever asked you. When you were a kid, did you ever have any experiences like that? Did you ever get scared at night because you thought something might be around? Did you ever see anything?
The only thing that comes to mind is I had a weird dream about playing with little people in the garden.
Oh, really?
Do you remember that story?
I do remember that story now.
And I remember I was probably 5 or 6 years old and I was living in England at the time in the Lake District, the home of little people and fairies. And I have this weird dream about little people in the garden and it was so real and vivid. The next day, I immediately got into my pajamas and, you know, put my pants on and ran down to the corner of the garden where I knew that this had taken place. And I remember just being so disappointed because the little people weren't there. And it was just a bunch of, like, mushrooms and stuff on the ground, like a little...
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
I guess it's interesting because obviously as a parent, you would write that off as, well, it's just a very vivid dream. But I guess to a child, it seems like it's something that's very vivid. As I was editing the interview yesterday, I actually had a memory come back, which just, it really struck me. And at the time... It's kind of funny because I know when it was. I know I was 2.5 years old because it was when I was taken up to this place called Bribery Island, which is on the sort of north of Brisbane off the Queensland coast. And my parents had gone up there because it was just before I was supposed to go into daycare or whatever it was. So they wanted to spend a weekend with me. And as I was there that night, I remember having this vivid experience where I got up and the house was pitch black and it was night. And I looked out the window and hovering outside in the window up in the sky was almost like this half moon kind of rainbow shaped crescent. It's the only way I could describe it. And I turned around and I was telling my mother apparently, because they found me standing in their room, just standing there saying that he's here. And I was saying, the count's here. So
what?
From Sesame Street.
You never told me this story.
And I had this, I think I told you a while ago, but it just came back to me. But I remember there actually
like
being.
Von.
Yeah.
Who?
No, I really do remember there being like something that kind of looked like a puppeted kind of purple count just in this strange, in this apartment that we were renting.
Yeah.
And
were you just binge watching Sesame Street?
Well, that's what I was wondering, right? But the strange thing is that the fact that it was verified by my mother that she just found me standing there, all I remember is coming to being in the room. It's kind of like this weird sleepwalking effect. But you know, as you grow older, you think, oh, well, maybe that could just be, well, I'm pretty sure it was just some vivid dream that you have as a young child. But it was so vivid and so visceral. The fact that I remember it now, 30 years later, it's just, I don't know, when you start looking at all these topics, you start wondering, what is it? What's the true nature behind that? What was I seeing?
Well, it's funny, our two examples are dreams.
Yeah.
Whereas the children that Nancy's working with, it's a little bit more than dreams.
Absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about some pretty extreme experiences, and especially her experience as a child, you know, seeing her uncle in this state with a medical condition and having no way of retrieving this information. And it's cases like that where you can verify what's observed in this out-of-body state that really does give it some scientific weight.
Yes.
And, you know, these are the cases that it seems that she's focusing on, trying to gather the data and make sense of what people are experiencing. So we'll link to everything in the show notes along with the courses that they're developing. And Nancy's working on some... A new presentation and a new YouTube video is going to be released in about 2 weeks' time.
Oh, fantastic.
So she's going to let me know when that's out, and I'll put that out on Twitter or mention it again on the show when it comes around. But let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, I want to set up what's coming up in the Plus extension and how we discovered where babies come from. And in a strange way, this does connect to what Nancy's researching.
Oh, really?
Because if you look back through history, this question of how is life formed, where did babies come from? The author, Edward Dolnick, he makes a case that this is exactly the same kind of Herculean task that scientists are facing today in trying to understand consciousness. This hard question of consciousness we discussed today and on last week's show, it seems insurmountable. But to the people that came before us, our ancestors, trying to figure out where life came from, how it was formed, it was the same insurmountable problem. How do you figure it out? And I feel like a lot of the people I'm going to be mentioning through history who made these incredible discoveries, in a similar way, people like Nancy and Bob Berman from last week,
they're pioneers.
They really are pioneers. Yeah. They're thinking outside the box, and they're making connections that are right under our noses that other people don't seem to make. So that's coming up after the break. We're going to answer the question of where babies come from. I mean, if you don't know already, now's your chance to find out. And we find out how it's related to frogs wearing pants.
Graphically.
It's very graphic. Stay with us. Before we go into our Plus extension, I want to introduce a little bit of this book for you, The Seeds of Life, from Aristotle to Da Vinci, from shark's teeth to frog's pants, the long and strange quest to discover where babies come from. Massive title from the author, Edward Dolnick. And he points out early on that by the late 1600s, this is the era when the scientific world began to take its modern shape. Explorers had circled the globe, they had mapped the heavens, they had calculated the weight of the earth, they had trace the paths of comets that cut through the sky and divined the secret of the Milky Way. They had uncovered mathematics at the heart of music, discovered the laws of perspective. But for thousands of years, long after Columbus and Magellan and Galileo, the deepest scientific riddle of all lay unsolved. Where do babies come from?
Isn't that weird? We're so advanced in all that technology and all that science, and yet we still don't know where babies come from.
No one had a clue. Now, people knew that, obviously, sex had something to do with it, but I'll get into some of the cultures that didn't. But everyone's asked this question, where do we come from? How does life begin? These are the most urgent of all scientific questions. So not everyone, he points out, has wondered, why do the stars shine in the sky, or why does the earth spin? But everyone wants to know where babies come from. I mean, we've all asked that question at some stage in our life. But throughout history...
Hopefully when you're a child.
Throughout history, no one had a clue. No one had any idea. He states the search for the solution to the sex and conception mystery would consume careers and span centuries. His focus is on the heart of the tale, and it's from 1650 to nearly 1900. And he's focusing on European scientists. And during this time, how scientists from Holland, France, England, Germany, and Italy, and even some from the United States would pass on this torch, then horrendously burn themselves with it, drop it, and make huge mistakes along the way.
Yeah, exactly.
He says the hardest problem in science today, it's so difficult that scientists refer to it as the hard problem. And of course, he's talking about why is it that it feels like something to be us what in short is consciousness? And he says, today, the deepest thinkers in the world can only stammer in response. And one day we might find the answers. But again, he points out in the past, the riddle of life seemed every bit as intractable as the riddle of consciousness does today. And it's funny because in some of the titles of the book, it's saying that it's like a, or the reviews, it's saying it's a misogynist look through history.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I thought, oh, is that, are they throwing some politics in this? But it really was the case. I mean, it
absolutely
was the case.
Yeah, absolutely.
Throughout history, I mean, all the scientific leaders, the vast majority of them were men, and their views on women were just that they were barely human.
Yeah, it's true.
Like, we were laughing about it at the start of the show. They thought that period blood was some horrible thing that would scare bees away from their hives and cause the crops to die. I mean,
that was the crops to wither.
Yeah, the crops to wither. So in terms, this was the great mystery. This was the stumbling block for a lot of scientists, is they just couldn't figure out women. I mean, they said plainly she carried the baby and she delivered it. But they would ask the question, well, did she contribute to the making of the baby? Because the male produced the semen. That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But what does the woman do? So the simplest answer throughout history, the most favorite answer from male thinkers, was that the woman was the field where a man planted his seed.
Right. Yeah.
That was it. And they have this quote from Aeschylus, the Greek writer. This is 4 centuries before Christ. Saying, the woman you call the mother of the child is not the parent, just the nurse to the seed, the new-sown seed that grow and swells inside her. The man is the source of life, the one who mounts. She, like a stranger for a stranger, keeps the shoot alive unless God hurts the roots. So that's all you ladies do.
It's so reductive, though, isn't
it? It's like a garden bed.
Oh,
it's like a field of dirt.
Yeah, field, yeah.
And then 20 centuries later, you're in England, and people still cling to that view.
Mm.
The King's Royal Physician states in a book on anatomy published in 1618, the woman hath a womb ordained by nature as a field or seed plot to receive and cherish the seed.
It's just so backwards. But you know what? I've seen 18th or maybe 17th century depictions of what sperm was, and it's been magnified in inverted commas, and it's tiny little people inside sperm.
Yeah.
And so you would plant that, obviously, in the field, and then it would grow. Like, just backwards ideas. But it wasn't backwards at the time.
Well, I find it so bizarre because anyone with half a brain can observe and see that when a woman gives birth to their child, there is a resemblance to the mother.
Yeah, but see, that would be explained that that's picked up from the mother because that's where the field was.
No, but they're arguing that the mother is just the field. In the same way, you see, even today in Egypt, for example, they still cling to this view. They still view...
Really?
Yeah, they still view... And Turkey as well. They still view the mother as just the crop,
oven.
The crop where the seed is planted.
Baby.
And they're actually arguing this book, like some of the people they interview Egyptian women. And they say, well, look, when you plant a seed in different fields, it doesn't change how the seed grows. It's still the plant comes from the seed. The field has no contribution to the plant. That's wow. Their argument.
Wow.
So I just find it so baffling.
Yeah,
how could you just look? Clearly that child looks like their mother. But, oh, no, the mother.
No, it's nothing to do with it.
The mother has nothing to do with it. So one of the problems was that of the two sexes, males presented less mystery because all our bits are on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just see it. You can observe it.
Yeah.
But people kind of understood the role of the penis. That's where the semen comes out of. But no one knew what the testicles were for. So Aristotle... And this was the belief for centuries, is that they're just counterweights. Like, they're just basically keeping men upright. They're just balancing.
But they're not heavy.
They're balancing us out.
But that doesn't even make sense.
If one of them gets damaged, like if there's any monoballs listening, I can understand why when you walk, you lean to one side. I totally understand now. It's because
makes
your
sense.
Counterweights are totally out of whack.
I get it.
So... And of course, semen was the impossible to miss product of sex, crucial part to the puzzle. People understood this. But the standard notion was that semen was just this some kind of magical concoction.
Right.
It had some kind of aura or ether to it. But of course, no one really understood how it worked. And again, back with women's anatomy, fallopian tubes, no one had any idea what that was. There was not even a name for ovaries. So through centuries, the women's reproductive organs were just called testes.
But surely...
ovaries were called testes.
Which is obviously wrong, but surely autopsies would have been done even back then, right? What about the macabre way that they used to perform examinations? Surely that they would have found that from women.
Well, I'm going to get into that in the Plus extension.
Oh.
And some of the fun family days out where you could go to the autopsy hall and watch your favourite physician slicing up a recently executed criminal.
Oh, God.
And you probably had your favorite physician, and it was all drama. Like, they'd have like a band playing some fiddle music, and
what?
The physician would wear like a fancy cape, and they would make it like a drama show, and they'd come out and like, now we're going to show
so
the brain.
Macabre.
And they would actually pass the organs around to the...
What, like a Halloween party?
Yeah, they'd pass it around the crowd, and it was really frowned upon if you stole like a liver or something. Yeah, it was bad form.
Oh, yeah, I'll take that.
If you took it. But it was really common to take your date to the autopsy theater.
What a hot date that would be.
Because have you ever been turned on when you're squeezing a dead murderer's liver? I mean, that really...
Not that I can recall, to be honest. I don't think that would really be my thing.
So before we get into that, we'll go into all of that in the Plus extension, and I'll explain how the science progressed. But before we get to that, I want to leave you with some of the examples from other cultures, because with many of history's great riddles, Dolnik writes, China or India or other non-Western cultures made huge breakthroughs before Europe.
Right.
And Europe was making or playing catch up. But that was the pattern in astronomy and the sciences, in mathematics and geography. But it wasn't the story in sex and conception. In the East, they kind of had it weirdly backwards as well. And when it came to the procreation, they were more focused on how to get pregnant or how to stop pregnancy from happening. So they would devise potions that led to pregnancy or...
or be loaded with lead.
Yeah, or stopped pregnancy. And where does the baby come from? It didn't really concern them as much as it did in Europe. So the most pressing question was why some sexual encounters led to pregnancy and why sometimes nothing happened at all. And there was all these countless stories around what food you ate, what the smell was like in the air, you know, just the atmosphere or what you were thinking had something to do with it. So they have all these examples, and there's some weird connections across cultures. Like in both China and Italy, eating flowers would lead to pregnancy. So
they're completely unconnected, but somehow they both had the same concept.
Yeah. So the Italians thought that if you ate roses, like a red rose would bring a boy, but if you ate a white rose, you'd have a girl. And in China, swallowing a stone or a pearl or drinking dew brought babies. In Ireland, drinking saints' tears brought babies.
Where do you get hold of saints' tears? You just walk down to the local milk bar and...
No idea.
A pint of saints' tears, please.
Is that like a name for a herb or something? Saints' tears?
I don't know.
But in the wonderful, ancient, mysterious culture of India, you would get pregnant if a bird accidentally shit in your mouth.
So if you're just
Hang on.
How many times in your life, and I'm asking you as a listener as well, have you known yourself or anyone else to have a bird accidentally shit in your mouth?
Well, there's a specific twist to it. It's got to be a crane. If it's just a seagull.
Oh, it's a crane.
If it's a seagull at the beach, which has happened to me, it's nothing. It's fine.
What
you're
about
okay.
A peacock or in
peacock's
other,
fine.
Right. It's got to be. But hang on. So what, do people go and lie underneath cranes with their mouths
no,
open?
It's by accident. So if you're yawning and you look up and the crane shits in your mouth and you're a girl, you get pregnant. So I like how all the other cultures are like, you've got to drink saints' tears and you have to consume the fresh rose petals. And in India, you just
have a bird shit in your mouth. A crane.
A crane shits in your mouth. So contraceptive techniques in other cultures were really bizarre as well. In ancient Rome, they had one preparation which was basically you would wrap it up in a bit of deer hide and tie it to the body, and the concoction was made of worms that lived in the head of a particular species of hairy spider.
Okay.
And that was your contraception.
So obviously it didn't work.
Well, maybe it did. I mean, would you want to have sex with someone who's got a deer hide strapped around them and inside it, it's full of these spider worms?
That suddenly breaks open. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Then a bubble grows on you after sex and you pop it and all these baby spiders come out.
Oh, God.
So in Egypt, they had, you've probably heard of this contraceptive recipe. I know this has been blogged about endlessly. But they have a recipe on papyrus where you use feces of crocodile all smashed up with fermented dough. And you shape this into a suppository, a vaginal suppository, and that is supposedly a great contraceptive method. And they had awesome aphrodisiacs too. So in the British Museum, there's this old Egyptian papyrus.
See, the Germans will call that Kuntenscheisen.
What?
Took you a second to get that.
I was considering whether I have to tag this to edit that out or just leave it in the show. I'll just leave it in. So anyway, the British Museum, they got this old papyrus. It's got the ingredient of a potion that allows you to get pregnant or allows, it's like an aphrodisiac.
So it facilitates.
Facilitates pregnancy. So let me read it out for you. Take a dandruff from the scalp of a dead man who was recently murdered.
Has to be murdered.
Step two. Add the blood of a tick from a black dog, a drop of blood from the ring finger of your left hand, and plenty of semen.
It's too much effort. I mean, who's going to that kind of effort?
It's like, you find a dead man.
The dead man I get, but everything else.
And you think, great, I've got the first ingredient for the potion, and you got to find, was he murdered? And no, he fell off a bridge. It's like, damn it. I've got to find another dead man that was recently murdered. Here's the thing I want to just finish on this before we go into plus. Some cultures never made the connection between sex and babies.
Right. So which culture is that?
All the idiots. All the really dumb ones. The most famous holdouts from history are the people of the Trobriand Islands, which today are part of Papua New Guinea. So years ago, an anthropologist, Bronislaw Malinowski, he went to investigate. He wanted to find out why they thought this way. And the explanation he learnt is quite complex. The Trobriand people, they say that when men and women die, their soul or spirit, the beloma they call it, it travels to another place. And this other place, it's not like a mystical heaven or the underworld or some magical place. It's literally the island next door.
Oh.
It's like you can see it from your beach. It's like, where do people go when they die? Oh, just over there. They're just over there.
Well, have spirits.
Have you built a boat to go and see? No, we've never thought of that. It's just the next island over. That's where everyone goes when they die. This island is called Tuma, and other people live on this island.
But there happens to be spirits there as well.
They're just convinced everyone goes there when they die. And on this island of Tuma, the spirits settle down with the belomas of their relatives and they live this afterlife. And it's kind of like the astral world we hear about from the theosophists. They eat, sleep, age, fall in love, eventually grow old. But when they leave, when it's their turn to leave the spirit world, they turn into this weird thing that kind of wriggles down to the beach and then kind of like a snake shedding its skin. It's like, imagine your grandma's dead on this island and she slithers out of a skin and she comes out as some kind of weird embryo and she kind of goes just like wiggles into the water. And then she
sounds like the Gould from Stargate. Remember
she,
that?
Well, I don't know what that is, but she starts swimming. Your grandma's spirit, she starts swimming in the water. And these embryos, these spirit embryos, the islanders call them the spirit children, and they're the key to the whole thing. So at some point,
does this worm thing head for the field?
At some point, a woman who's alive from the tribe, the Trobriand tribe, they'll be at the beach bathing, they'll be in the water, and they'll feel this wormy thing, one of their ancestors, swim up into their vagina.
Is this why you were looking today for audio sounds of a pneumatic tube?
Yeah, it's like a... And then they're pregnant. And that's where babies come from.
I'm going to tell my kids that. That's, you know, I know that question will come one day, and that is going to be my answer.
That's how you explain it.
No, I'll get you to do it. I'm like, Uncle Ben will explain all of it to you. Sound effects included.
They'll feel like something's touched them or something swam up inside them, and then they realize that they're pregnant. So this Malinowski guy, he's hearing this just going, are you people insane? I mean, I'm an anthropologist. I've heard some creation stories in my time. But this is crazy. What about sex? So he says, okay, guys, what about an unmarried woman? And he goes up to an unmarried woman and he asks who the father of the baby is. And he's just met with puzzled stares. And they just keep telling him, well, no, it's one of the Belomas. They swam up into her vagina and now she's pregnant. What are you talking about, you idiot white man?
No concept of it.
And even when a man from the tribe left for years and then came back and his wife was pregnant, it wasn't a problem because they don't understand.
No, they just think that she was out swimming somewhere and somehow she received a deposit.
She was just in the water for too long at the beach and she got pregnant.
This is like high school. I mean, there are people in my high school. It shows you the caliber of high school I went to when someone in my grade actually thought that she could get pregnant from kissing.
Yeah.
Don't know how I got out of there, but I did.
So Malinowski, he starts to try and explain to them that he uses the simile, again, because this was the knowledge of the time, that what about the concept of the semen planting in a field and it slowly cultivating it and giving life? And he said he launched into this simile trying to explain it. And he explained that, well, at the end of him trying to demonstrate this to the villagers, they all thought he was a freak. They totally misunderstood. They thought that the white man literally grows babies from the soil in the fields.
Oh.
So they then thought white men were just aliens, basically. So, but finally, he thought he had made a breakthrough. He thought that he had figured out a way to convince them that there was a link between sex and having babies. So he said, look, there's a girl in your tribe, right? She's never had sex before, so she's not going to have a baby. And the villagers realize, oh, he's right.
No, but hang on. If she's been in the water, well, then it doesn't matter.
Well, they say, no, but they think there must be a link. Maybe there's something to this. And he thinks he's actually convinced them. So he rattles off some more questions, but finally his good cheer vanished because they explained to him that, well, no. Sex does have something to do with it.
Oh, finally. Okay.
Thinks, finally. Okay. What's your understanding? And the villagers explain that the reason a woman that's never had sex doesn't get pregnant is because her vagina is way too tight. And the act of sex slowly, it's like a mechanism. They explain this mechanism. It's like if there's enough sex going on, eventually, look, the vagina gets wider so that when she goes into the water, clearly there's a bigger opening for the spirit fish to swim up there. I mean, how stupid are you, white man? This is so obvious.
And let me guess, does more sex lead to a wider opening?
Correct. You've got it.
Oh, God.
And that's where babies come from. That's it.
And that, children, is where babies come from. Oh, God, Ben.
So we've got... I've got even more.
I hate to think what you've got coming up in Plus, yeah, honestly.
Well, I didn't want to put the dirty stuff in the free show, so that's coming up in the Plus extension in a moment.
Awesome. And we'll also be going into the new Mothman sightings across Chicago. And also, I have an update on the pterodactyl saga that happened in Yorkshire as well. So there's some stuff that I dug a little bit further into some of the research. Nick Redfern pointed me in the right direction. And there's this weird cultish effect that's all caught up in it. Very, very strange.
When Julie sent me those links to the story, I wasn't sure how legit it was, but you seem to have been researching it all afternoon.
There's definitely something going on. Yeah, without a doubt. And this is a problem. Obviously, anything on the internet, you can go, well, people can make stuff up. But Lon Strickler has been involved. And of course, you know, Lon's got that great blog, Phantoms and Monsters. He's done a lot of investigation into this. And it seems to me that on the whole, most of these reports are coming from genuine people. I'm not saying whether or not, you know, maybe it's a misidentification, but it seems like the reports, and I picked a handful for you, which I'm going to read for you, are very bizarre and have a lot of elements of high strangeness involved with them.
It's not Baron Trump and his time machine.
with his fidget spinner time travel device. No, it's not that. No, close. There is a bird person involved. I'll give you
that. Okay. Yeah. Amazing stuff coming up in our Plus extension. Make sure you get access to that. To become a member, go to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get extensions on these shows every single week. Massive extensions. I've got the Seeds of Life coming up. We're finally going to answer this question of, do babies come from the sperm or the egg? Is it the spermists or the ovists? Who is correct in the battle royale? Seed of life.
I don't think I want to know.
It's just the fish spirits.
The fish spirits. Yeah, that works. Yeah, that works.
We've got all our Mothman updates coming up. If you're a listener from Chicago, which I know many of you are, look out. Something's coming. On our Plus membership, you also get an exclusive episode every single Tuesday. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus, and you're getting a higher bitrate feed. We give you a 320 kilobits per second version of the show, the best sound quality we put out. You get a massive discount on our back catalogue store. We've still got the 50% off promotion running for Plus members. You get all the features of our apps unlocked as well, and a totally ad-free version of the podcast. It's only $9 a month. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus for all the details. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Make sure you check out the show notes. Mysteriousuniverse.org. Look for season 18, episode 5. That's a wrap for this free show. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us. On this quest for the knowledge of the seed of life, we've established that there are some cultures that, yeah, didn't make the connection between sex and babies.
I guess it's easy from a modern perspective.